in Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, The Morning Show with Greg Berg, up next. Support for The Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD-HD. Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm delighted to welcome back to our studios for his monthly visit to the program, Dr. Art Sear, Clawson Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage College, Director of the Clawson Center, and author of After the Cold War. Dr. Sear joins us on a regular basis to offer his insights on what's going on here and around the world. And, of course, I'm sure many of you read Professor Sear's column, which appears in newspapers across the country. And maybe some of you even...
And in the Kenosha News.
Right, of course. And some of you maybe even adjust your radio dial a little bit and hear Dr. Sear when he is on the air at WUWM. But WGTD has him today. And, Professor Sear, we welcome you back to the program.
Well, thank you, Greg. I appreciate always being with you and colleagues here.
Good to have you here. There are, it seems like, an exceptionally long list of important things for us to be talking about. And right at the top of the list is the nation of China. And, of course, a move. China is in the headlines right now for a couple of different reasons. Most unhappily, in the last day and a half or so, after these horrific explosions which occurred there. But then, of course, just ahead of that, China had already made headlines here because of a move which they made involving their currency, a move which seems to be having some repercussions around the world economically. So tell us what you understand about maybe the context in which China made the decision that that they did regarding the devaluing of their currency.
China, like Korea, South Korea, and other nations, an increasing number in the world, actually, which is good news, has been undergoing an enormous but also very, very fast-moving industrial revolution. That's extremely disruptive. It's a factor, I believe, in this terrible explosion. series of explosions that occurred in Tianjin.
How so? I'm curious about that.
You're going to ask me to explain myself, huh? Instead of just expatiate. When you're an industrial revolution involves a tremendous amount of social dislocation, it's why traditional conservatives, they were the ones who were most concerned, even though you'd think they'd be friendly to capitalism in Britain, were really concerned about the first industrial revolution there. You're moving large amounts of physical goods. You're creating new things. You're dealing with new and unfamiliar machinery.
Ah.
And I think that's the much more likely explanation. We Americans
sure.
are paranoid, especially since 9/11, but I'd be surprised if it were sabotage or some
right.
sort of external attack.
So often in rapid expansion, mistakes get made and
well,
so
yes,
on.
And they were dealing pretty casually with a lot of very, very volatile material. I've only been to the mainland twice. I've been to Taiwan much more frequently in my working life. I went to the mainland in 1996, a fascinating trip, but I recall flying out of Shanghai, the big commercial and industrial center. Then it's now huge, buildings literally going up overnight and new freeways. My window seat was by the happened to be by the fuel tank. The plane was being refueled, and there was a worker very casually smoking a cigarette as he put the gas, the highly volatile airline fuel
wow.
nozzle into the tank of the plane. A good metaphor and good symbol. A similar terrible disaster in this country was the Texas City explosions in 1947. Ammonium nitrate, very important as a fertilizer, but also extremely dangerous and volatile. Exploded and a ship literally blew apart. Literally, an entire large freighter
wow.
was blown to bits. Fires went on for 3 days. About 600 people were killed. Nobody knows for sure the exact
wow.
death toll, but the body count was somewhere around 600. In 1955, the federal government simply wound up paying a large amount of money to all claimants, all parties involved, to get this terrible disaster behind us. We tend sometimes to feel superior, I believe, in looking at third world countries, and it's led to some big miscalculations in our foreign policy in the past, in my biased view. That was certainly true vis-a-vis Japan before Pearl Harbor. And it's important to keep in mind that rapid change, rapid industrial change, technological evolution, that's challenging for everybody.
Wow.
But it's remarkably similar. I was thinking about this, and I remember as a child reading about, a very small child, reading about the settlement in 55, and the media really, really emphasized the enormous scale of this explosion right in our own country.
I don't know anything about that, so I'm glad you brought that up. And it's interesting.
Well, I don't know much about it either, but it does
right.
bear directly on
yeah,
this.
Of course.
This
and,
event.
Right, and it's interesting to think about the very human kind of mistakes that very likely may have led to this disaster in China. And that, of course, actually flies in the face of something else. And I think there's kind of a history here in the United States of even now, even as sort of the gateway to China has opened up a little bit more. But I think
a lot more.
Right. But I think for a lot of us, nevertheless, we almost tend to assign to the Chinese almost superhuman qualities of incredible, almost brutal efficiency, and in reaction to the incredible strides which they have made as a nation, we sometimes forget on some strange level that China is inhabited by human beings, fallible human beings, and chances are fallible human beings have something to do with this disaster.
Yeah.
What about the context within which China made this rather dramatic move in involving its currency? What would have prompted China to do that? The same thing you were starting to talk about in terms of this sort of rapid mobilization of its economy? Has that gotten them in some kind of trouble?
Yes, they have a very large and active stock market and equities trading more generally in China. Their stock market has been going down. The government has intervened, as governments tend to do, especially with an authoritarian, in their case totalitarian history, to try to prop the market up. In a truly open large market, you can only go so far with that kind of thing. If you're Switzerland or Israel, smaller states can actually do this and have some effect, at least for a while. Really big economies cannot. The government, in effect, finally threw in the towel politically, decided to face economic reality. And they're not making totally free, I don't believe, but they're becoming less assertive in trying to control their currency. Their currency is overvalued thanks to government manipulation of the currency. Not just telling corporations what to do in the stock market, but also the central bank has been actively trying to manipulate the currency. I believe, as a non-banker, not a practicing economist, really, that that's something you can do for a while, but it doesn't change basic structural realities. So to make their goods more competitive overseas and also face the financial reality, they have effectively devalued their currency, which means that they'll be able to sell goods overseas. It doesn't take care of basic structural problems. Devaluing your currency, if you're not really competitive, will only short-term help your balance of payments, balance of trade. But in the case of China, it's such a rapidly evolving, very powerful economy. I think the breathing room may make a difference positively for them, and at least they are facing reality, which is good.
Well, it certainly caused quite a stir on markets around the world, including our own stock market, which seemed to react very, very badly to that. And what some analysts, at least, are saying is that this, if it helps them sell their goods over here, this move also makes it potentially more difficult for us to sell our goods over there because the dollar is more powerful by comparison, and suddenly our goods are more expensive for the average Chinese citizen to purchase. How significant do you think that is? I mean, is that an overreaction, or is that in fact a cause of real concern?
Yes, that is an overreaction. Keep in mind that the media have their own problems, and individual reporters and analysts and spokespeople, especially in the television media, where they're actually much more likely to be aspiring actors than actual journalists. And I'm not just speaking about Fox News. These people are concerned about their jobs. They're hyping constantly. We have not had any kind of big stock market crash in this country, but we talk as though that is imminent or might even be occurring. That's point number one. Point number two, thanks to the genius and strength and real virtue of capitalism, it does have them. It does have virtues. It's not them and us when it comes to trade. An awful lot of the most significant players, and increasingly the most significant players commercially, are us. That is, foreigners, especially Americans, American multinationals, investing in China. The most profitable companies tend to be, over there, tend to be companies that are foreign, often American, in origin and management. When you're talking about goods from China, you're talking about Sara Lee, you're talking about Ford Motor Company, GM, you're talking about all kinds of U.S. companies.
Right. So that us versus them paradigm from the Cold War,
yeah,
just doesn't apply anymore, but we forget that.
Well, especially because capital, in a very real sense, has a life of its own. At least it's separate from governments. Capital controls haven't been present on the part of nations since the 1960s. Really, there's more and more capital, more and more liquid capital in the world, and it's very hard for any government, even a very strong dictatorial regime like the communist regime in China, to control that if they really want to have a productive, relatively open economy. If you do try to control things totally, you wind up like the North Koreans or like the Cubans. Until recently, you have less and less capital, and you're dependent more and more on ideological subsidies from the outside, which long-term is even worse, is far worse for the people. It's far worse for everyone but the guys at the top.
Right.
if you try today, if you try to deny the marketplace.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. Art Sear from the faculty of Carthage College. He is here for his monthly visit to the program to offer his thoughts on a variety of stories and topics of current interest. I thought it was interesting that in two of your most recent columns, two different recent columns, you made prominent mention of the nation of Turkey, which, of course, the importance of Turkey cannot be probably overemphasized. In one of those columns, you were talking very directly about Turkey and its shifting role in the war against ISIS. In the other, you were talking actually primarily about the nation of Greece, and at one point talking then about the relationship between Greece and Turkey and in the wake of course, Greece's economic woes. So it's just kind of probably underscored again how important Turkey is and how you want us all to remember that.
Turkey is important and increasingly important in the economic realm we've been discussing. They used to be the sick man of Europe, sick person of Europe economically, kind of replacing the Italians as the post-World War II period went on. Lots of inflation, lots of corruption, especially since the regime of Prime Minister Turgut Özal during the time of the first Gulf War, the late 80s, well into the 90s, Turkey has reformed dramatically. It's a very, very large economy. Physically, they have tremendous potential. Geographically, they're in an extremely good location. Traditionally, they're a very important friend of the U.S., a strategic relationship cemented by Özal and his good friend, George Herbert Walker Bush. They had an extremely good relationship, and Bush Sr. used to work at this assiduously from a very young age, which paid off tremendously when he was president, not just vis-a-vis Turkey. They're an important military ally of the U.S. historically, despite recent headlines and problems with their extremist, rather erratic Prime Minister Erdogan, now the president. They joined NATO right away. They have a ferocious warrior culture, historically very close to Germany. They were allied with Germany in the First World War. They were smart enough to stay away from the Third Reich in the Second War. And then came in on the side of the Allies in the last year of the war. They sent a lot of troops to Korea during the Korean War. There was a UN cemetery, which is quite moving. I urge people to visit it. A UN cemetery at Busan, a crucial battlefield, fairly early in the war. A lot of American and South Korean graves, an awful lot of Turkish graves as well. I mentioned in the article related to Greece that Secretary of State Kerry, who I think is a really formidable and effective Secretary of State and may well ultimately be listed among great Secretaries of State, he has a strategic opportunity, I think, to, in the current situation, to really encourage closer cooperation between Greece and Turkey, traditional enemies. But in the current context, there are great opportunities, I believe, for strong cooperation between the two in the context of NATO as well as the European Union.
You mentioned in your other column how Turkey has, in the struggle against ISIS, is shifting its policy in a sense, and you talked about how it's really taking aim much more directly. So it's not just allowing the U.S.-led coalition to have more of a presence in Turkey, but Turkey themselves is also taking the fight to ISIS more directly.
That's right. They're facing strategic reality, as far as I'm concerned, and that's all to the good. You can very easily lapse into cliches discussing Turkey, the bridge nation between East and West, between Europe and the Islamic world. But it is true. And it means that it's extremely important for us to maintain, insofar as we can, positive relations with Turkey. And thanks to the unifying threat of ISIS, we now are relatively close.
Speaking of the current Secretary of State, we should probably talk for at least a moment about the recently brokered nuclear agreement with Iran, which, of course, has come under very, very fierce criticism from the Republican side of the aisle, and there are a few Democrats who are joining in this chorus of displeasure about this agreement. From what you understand in terms of the agreement reached, are these concerns well-placed? Are there grounds to be concerned about this agreement?
Yes, of course. We are essentially hostile nations, Iran and the U.S., and have been since 1979. I believe the agreement is positive and worthwhile and in our interest. It's better than not having an agreement, which would free up Iran without restraint to pursue nuclear weapons if they so chose. It's important to keep in mind that it's not just the U.S. and Iran. The Obama administration has been dealing with five other important partners, including Russia and China, as well as Britain, France, and the special case of Germany, which has, again, rather close historic ties with Iran and before that Persia. Even if we decided unilaterally to veto the deal, these other countries are in favor of it, as is the EU and the UN. So it's not a matter of Washington, the White House, being able unilaterally to keep the much-discussed billions of dollars from going back to Iran. It is their money. We should, as law-abiding Americans interested in world stability, be happy about the fact that we've had this very diverse coalition working together to maintain these sanctions on Iran, which has seriously and significantly damaged their economy. And even if we weren't in favor of the deal, these other countries would be, and these Iran funds would be released. It's important to make that point because we've demonized Iran so long, and the rhetoric has been overheated for so long, and politicians in Israel, as well as the United States, are so anxious, frankly, to take advantage of the situation. Sometimes because their beliefs are sincerely held, but not always. It's really important to keep this in mind. The International Atomic Energy Agency is a durable and viable international organization established at President Eisenhower's initiative in 1957. They have a very good track record of carrying out effective inspections. They're a big reason, the main reason, why nuclear weapons proliferation hasn't gone on more actively over time. And finally, Iran, beneath all the rhetoric on both sides, in Iran as well as in the U.S., has actually shown considerable restraint. I'm not defending the regime, and I'm not minimizing their criminal and terrorist activity. But a U.S. ally at the time, Iraq, at the end of the 1980s, during the long Iran-Iraq war, used poison gas against Iran. The Iranians did not respond in kind. The USS Vincennes in 1988, at about the same time, but quite by accident, shot down an Iran Air civilian airliner, killed several hundred people, including about 60 children. Iran did not attempt to respond in kind, and finally, after very painful negotiations, there was a substantial financial settlement. They are an active supporter of terrorism against Israel. They're making mischief in Yemen and elsewhere. They are steadily emerging as the principal regional power in that part of the world, a direct consequence of our invasion of Iraq in 2003. And I believe we have to face this reality. I'm very sorry that the Obama administration, the president, seems to go out of his way, from my point of view, to slap Congress in the face, especially when things seem to be improving. He made a big deal about submitting the Iran agreement to the UN before congressional discussion.
Right.
Now, that would have gone on anyway, but the White House has been anxious to take credit for submitting this to the UN, in effect, an end run around Congress. Bob Corker, Republican, chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, very powerful guy, very pragmatic guy. He, along with Mitch McConnell, has on important occasions been quite willing to work with the White House and reach accommodation that brings both sides together. He's been particularly enraged and particularly public about this. Why the president does this, it depends on your point of view, I think, how you explain it. I think inexperience has something to do with it. But the administration, meaning the White House, has made this an extremely painful process. And eventually, it may well be, in effect, declined by Congress, which is not a deal breaker or killer, but it'll make things much more difficult in terms of our dealings with Iran.
Right. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. Art Sear, director of the Clausen Center, Clausen Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage College, joining us today for his monthly visit to offer his analysis of current events. Secretary Kerry has also been very busy with our very close neighbor of Cuba. And as a matter of fact, as even as we speak, I think he's in Havana now. Or if not there now, he's on his way.
Imminent.
Right.
Current news.
What do you make of that new relationship, a resumed relationship between the United States and Cuba? Cuba, of course, is a tiny little nation. In proximity, they're important to us. But in any other ways, is this, in fact, significant beyond just, sort of it's for its historic interest? Are there real tangible reasons why, in fact, this should matter to every American?
It's not actually a tiny little nation. Just before the disastrous Bay of Pigs invasion was launched, during one of the actually rather disorderly briefings that the very new Kennedy White House staff put together, David Shoup map of Cuba up on a screen pointed drew the president and the others' attention to a small dot on this map, and he said, "I'd like to point this out to you. Do you know? Does anyone know what this represents? This little squiggly symbol?" And it was a rhetorical question. He said it was the island of Tarawa, one of the horrific battlefields in the Pacific War early on. We took the island. It was very, very costly. A lot of Marines died, and many, many more Japanese died. He was making the point that he felt the administration was being too casual in planning. Cuba is a big place.
And bigger than we think of it sometimes.
Yeah, and they're a tremendous source of raw materials. And there is a large residual infrastructure economically. In 1959, when the Castro brothers took over, and regime quickly made clear that it was a very different kind of kettle of fish kind of regime, a communist-slash-gangster regime, not just the usual dictatorial gangster regime that we were used to in Cuba and other parts of Latin America. Cuba had the highest per capita income in Latin America. It was in many ways the most advanced economy. Now, that was very unequally distributed, and it was
within its population?
Yeah. I mean, the vast mass lived in relative poverty, and the men at the top really cleaned up in crude economic and material terms. But there is a very large infrastructure in Cuba. It's a source of raw materials. Tom Clausen, who was a very active venture capitalist, angel investor in the current vernacular, after he retired from Bank of America the second time, he lived many more years. He was a very active investor, and it was interesting to me when I first came to Carthage. He was involved with a group of similar entrepreneurs and investors who were most anxious to go to Cuba. After the government shot down a small plane that was piloted by anti-Castro activists who were always active, things clamped down even before the George W. Bush administration took office. But I was impressed by the fact that an awful lot of investors, individual and corporate, have been anxious to get back into Cuba. And you can understand why. It isn't a tiny country. I don't want to overreact to your comment. It's a very sizable country.
And just to be clear, I'm trying to reflect the attitude of the typical American as they look on a map or look on a globe. That's just I think that's the way the vast majority of Americans see Cuba.
Well, we also historically, I'm glad to continue to quarrel with you if you wish. We saw Castro as soon as he declared himself in effect as a communist, it became an obsession of American public opinion. And President Kennedy, as Senator Kennedy, the candidate in 1960, took advantage of this emotion and greatly magnified this. Theodore H. White, in his classic book, The Making of the President, 1960, goes on at length about the bearded maniac 90 miles from our port. So Cuba was huge in some ways. But you're right, it's a small country and not a major power. I think there's a lot of commercial pressure to get back into Cuba. And also opinion has changed. We fortunately don't have this obsession that was so historically rooted and played such a big role in American politics.
Right.
And may again, if Marco Rubio gets traction on this, but I don't think he will.
So just clarify for us what exactly changes now with an American flag flying in Havana now for the first time in decades and John Kerry being there and our relations opening up. I mean, what in more tangible terms is expected to occur now between our two nations?
I believe it will. That's a very good question. I believe it will facilitate the already significantly increasing financial and other commercial contacts, but especially financial contacts and exchanges. It will facilitate travel back and forth, especially by families divided, families and friends divided by the traditional embargo. It's a process that President Obama started very early in his administration in terms of making it easier for family members, especially to contact one another for financial transfers, retail financial transfers, to occur and for communication to occur. I think it'll become an issue, especially in the 2016 campaign. I'd be surprised if the Republican Senate confirmed an ambassador, or at least not easily, unless the White House becomes a lot more skillful and nimble in dealing with Congress than has been the case. Maybe they will, but even without an ambassador, with formal relations, which an executive can declare, even if there's no formal ambassador, things will become much easier. And all these very powerful economic interests, especially American interests that want to get back into Cuba, will to a significant degree be satisfied. I think that's what's going to happen. Also, it remains a very, very tight dictatorship. Cuban intelligence, state police, they're remarkably effective, remarkably ruthless, remarkably brutal on a selective basis. I think it's got to at least somewhat weaken this police state. When you have lots of tourists, as well as lots of Western business types and others running around, you can't maintain traditional state control.
We've been talking about current Secretary of State John Kerry. We should talk for just a moment about former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, who, of course, is also the front runner on the Democratic side for vying for the Democratic presidential nomination for this next upcoming election, of course. But she is also been in the headlines as of late because of this ongoing concern involving the way in which she utilized some sort of private email carrier for at least quite a few of the emails which she engaged in, activity she engaged in as Secretary of State. And of course, the charge by some is that to do so was perhaps a foolishly dangerous thing to do. If her emails were involving any kind of classified information or information that was particularly sensitive, might it not be very prey to outside prying eyes? Where do you see this going? And do those of us on the sidelines observing this, do we even know enough to be able to have much of an opinion about just whether or not these concerns are well-founded or not?
Well, you don't have to know much to have an opinion. At least I don't. But kidding aside,
no kidding.
It does seem to have political traction. And it does play into an image, a negative image that I believe plagues Hillary Clinton and to a degree Bill Clinton, this sort of casual cavalier attitude about the rules and a sense of entitlement. I believe today there are advantages. There are and should be advantages. Inherent advantages to any woman candidate running for high office, There are listeners who won't agree with that, but I believe that's true. There are also significant and lingering disadvantages. In the case of Hillary Clinton especially, I believe she has to convince the voters that she is running for chief executive. She's not running for queen. And a sense of entitlement and a sense of special privilege and a sense of I can do what I want in this particular case is something that you have to avoid. So, from a safe distance and just sort of kibitzing from the sidelines, it does seem to me this does play to a weakness of hers.
Hmm. What about the reality of just how foolish it was to do what she did in terms of utilizing a private email carrier?
Yes.
And so on? Are we in a position to even begin to understand that yet, or is that simply just not determined yet?
No.
And will we ever know just how at risk some of this information was because of what she did?
Well, it's bad form, and good form is important any time, but especially if you're in a very senior and sensitive public position. And these rules, I gather, are quite strictly enforced. Certainly they should be. It's the kind of thing that General Petraeus was prosecuted for, although in his case it was a matter of taking some classified papers and rather casually putting them in a drawer and reportedly sharing them with a close friend of his, former head of the CIA in a previous administration, a gentleman with an academic background, I think from MIT, got in trouble because he rather casually transferred classified information, probably using an old computer disk in this case, to his home computer. I'm a Washington big shot. I'm so important, the usual rules don't apply to me. That's a danger for anyone in that kind of position. I actually think we've become a lot more consistent and a lot more fair and equal in law enforcement, in rule enforcement in Washington than was the case in earlier generations, and that's all to the good. But it's obviously got legs in the media and politically, and my guess is the Republicans are going to unleash. This is fairly carefully planned on their part. My guess is there's damaging information that the campaign and congressional Republicans are planning to unleash closer to primary time.
Do you have anything to say about the speculation that's just emerged in the last 24 hours or so that Al Gore might possibly be interested in entering the fray?
Well, of course, I pay attention and study and follow public radio and television all the time, but especially right up to the instant of appearing on your program. And an actual Al Gore spokesman has formally denied that he's planning to run. That doesn't mean he absolutely won't run, but he's been out of it even longer than Jeb Bush. And it would be pretty hard. I find it much more plausible that the current Vice President, Joe Biden, will run. Also, Al Gore actually won the popular vote in 2000 by about 500,000. He is extremely hardworking. He's extremely intelligent, whether you support him or not, or have any opinion. He's also become extremely rich. He's talking about venture capitalists and Mr. Clausen at the beginning. There are all kinds of opportunities when you leave high office in Washington, but he has become exceptionally wealthy by reliable because he's a very good investor, very astute. And we've both met people who are very good and successful in business. It's hard to see them running for anything outside of the boardroom except maybe the school board. There are tremendous politicians, very, very effective, who aren't really very good executives, and it's hard to see them operating in the business world. George H.W. Bush, I find impressive because he actually could do both. But very few of them can. But Al Gore has been a very, very good investor. And at this point in his life, at his age, with tremendous wealth, the question arises, do I really want to go back into that ordeal, the frying pan, the pressure cooker?
That quagmire. Whatever.
The heat of the kitchen. Yes, you can go on and on and on. It's a tough way. It really is a tough way to get ahead.
Right, and come up with a lot of ugly pictures, that's for sure.
Right. So my guess is no, he's not going to run. But others will, especially because Bernie Sanders is now ahead of Hillary Clinton in reliable New Hampshire polls. and we're not even there yet in the primaries.
Wow, interesting. You wrote such an interesting column about the Republicans and the Democrats and how, in some respects, things are a bit topsy-turvy at the moment.
Did I say topsy-turvy?
You didn't say that. I'm saying that. But that's essentially what you conveyed, that traditionally the Republicans have fielded candidates that were undeniably experienced and veterans in the business and so on. But in this particular case, they have at the top of the polls someone who is very much an outsider and a maverick and has never been elected to political office of any kind.
Yeah.
And then on the other side, of course, we have a front runner on the Democratic side, at least front runner in most polls, who's, you know, some would say kind of the ultimate insider, mm-hmm. Who's been, you know, part of the political game for a long, long time. And I just found that fascinating. I hadn't really stopped to think about the irony of that, given what has traditionally been the makeup of presidential candidates for the Democrats and Republicans over the last, well, 4 or 5 decades, right?
Yeah.
Spell that out for our listeners. I think it's those who didn't get to see your column, because I think it's a really interesting observation.
I believe that's coming up in the Kenosha News on Monday. So for a lot of papers, it's not out yet, although it's Gatehouse Media put it out yesterday. The Republican Party since World War II, that's a long time, but not so long in the history of the Great Republic. Since World War II, the Republicans pretty consistently have nominated the runner-up from last time around. Mitt Romney was the principal runner-up to John McCain.
Hmm.
McCain was the runner-up to George W. Bush. Bob Dole, their 1996 nominee, had been a challenger to George H.W. Bush in 88, and he'd been their vice presidential nominee in 76. They tend to pick known quantities. The two exceptions I cited, kind of two extremes, are Barry Goldwater in 1964 and Dwight Eisenhower in 1952. Both were very well known. Goldwater, a longtime senator, but he was very much an outsider regarding the Republican establishment. Ike was a genius at Army politics, at Washington politics, at international politics, and it spearheaded the largest and most complicated alliance in history to total victory, thank God, in World War II in Europe. But he neither one of them fit the format.
Hmm.
In 1940, a very desperate Republican Party picked Wendell Willkie, a big business type, kind of like Donald Trump, except he was sane and serious from my point of view. But the Republicans were desperate. The FDR was running for a third term. It looked like he was going to get in again. But generally, the Republicans have been predictable. The Democrats have been less predictable. Bill Clinton, Jimmy Carter, John Kennedy, believe it or not known quantities for the average voter and not people who were part of the senior establishment of the party who'd earned their spurs by running earlier. The Democrats historically have been less predictable since the war. That was the main point. It means probably Trump is not going to last. His negatives are very high. I also mentioned in the article that at this time last time around in the 2012 campaign, early front runners, Michelle Bachmann and Herman Cain, both of whom flamed out quite early. Mr. Cain had rather different problems. Ms. Bachmann was kind of like Donald Trump in the sense that the more you saw of her, the more kind of disturbing she was with off-the-wall erratic statements and behavior. Now, comparisons are invidious, and each of these people has strengths and ought to be commended for running. But it'll be historically extraordinary if the Republicans primary voters decide to support Donald Trump in reality.
Hmm. That being said, are you surprised that his numbers are remaining so tenaciously high, given these high negatives, given the way in which he has spoken out so frankly, so forthrightly, and some would say so recklessly on a lot of different issues? I mean, I think a lot of people were expecting those poll numbers to plunge, and they're not.
Well, I didn't predict it. That's the main thing. I didn't predict his rise, but professors work hard at not being, understanding things, and it certainly is in line with the tremendous alienation from Washington. And in the Republican Party, you can see a grassroots, especially blue-collar voters who, starting with Reagan, starting with Eisenhower, actually have moved to the Republican Party, but particularly dramatically during the Reagan era, how they'd be upset by the sense of these Washington big shots, in effect, neglecting the average American. We've recovered from the recession, but unemployment and underemployment remain persistently high in this country. Income inequality is growing, and Trump is kind of a nightmare version, a really extreme version of this populism in the U.S. It would be a sea change if Republican voters at large actually embraced this guy. But in many ways, he personifies, and I hope I don't sound too stuffy, he personifies the fact that our politics have become more and more celebrity entertainment. News broadcasts are, with the exception of a few media, are more and more superficial, given to personalities and entertainment. So he's kind of atypical for the Republican Party, but he's sort of the next step from the Kardashians, the next step from tabloid TV becoming mainstream, tabloid media becoming mainstream, electronic as well as print.
Right. Well, whatever you think of him and however you align or don't align with what he believes and what he stands for, there's nothing dull about him. He is a fascinating guy, and he persistently says fascinating things and pulls no punches, has no hesitation, and really there's no surprise there in terms of us being fascinated by him.
Yes, and that is not a surprise beyond parties and personalities. Ross Perot in 92 and 96, who effectively elected Bill Clinton, just as Mr. Trump could have elected Mrs. Clinton, ultimately running as a third-party candidate. George Wallace, in my lifetime, the most dangerous and most important third-party figure was George Wallace in the 68 campaign. Southern Democrat, demagogue, flamboyant, segregationist governor of Alabama. Hubert Humphrey, for a while, was behind both Nixon and Wallace in opinion polls. I mean, way behind.
Wow.
Humphrey finished in a dead heat with Nixon, showing what a phenomenal politician Hubert Humphrey really was, given everything against him, and I mean everything, in 68. Right. But another 10,000 votes away from Nixon in Tennessee and another 50,000 votes away from Nixon in Ohio, and Wallace could have had the whip hand. It almost went into the House of Representatives. He was a regional candidate. There's no viable regional third party in the U.S. today or third party candidate today. This populism, which is a powerful strain in U.S. politics, used to be more important because regional differences were more important. Franklin Roosevelt, in 1936, he was reelected. But the New Deal was in trouble. The country was in trouble still. He predicted to the few people he trusted, meaning I think his wife, his mother, Harry Hopkins, and maybe two or three others, he thought that Huey Long, our version, our homegrown fascist from Louisiana, he thought Huey Long would beat him out for the Democratic nomination. And even if he didn't, even if FDR was able to get renominated, he told people he thought Long had, and this guy was a genius at knowing the political winds and riptides in those days. He thought Long would get elected as a third-party candidate. Huey Long was assassinated before that happened. But that I emphasize this to bring home just how powerful American populism has been and remains.
And, of course, you talk in this same column about how traditionally the Democratic and Republican Party organizations had such a hand in determining the nominees. But in your words today, these filters and gatekeepers are largely gone, which is why somebody like a Donald Trump can have the presence that he does.
Well, I believe primaries have become too important, but I'm pretty traditional. Eisenhower and Stevenson, two very good candidates in hindsight. In the 50s, that was the last time the party bosses really had decisive decisive control. Harry Truman was picked by the party bosses, again in a much more challenging time for this country, when they knew that FDR was not going to live through his fourth term.
Well, on that note, we have to draw to a close. It's been an exceptionally active and interesting hour. We jumped among a lot of different important topics, and I trust that we will have more of the same when you rejoin us in September for your visit. So it's always great.